seat. Thank you. All right, good afternoon. Good morning, still. This is a time set for docket number 91394. Argument is set at 64 minutes, 32 per side. Are both sides ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. How much time does appellant wish to hold for rebuttal?
7 minutes, please.
Okay. And Ms., I pronounce it defects, yes?
Yes, that's
all right.
Correct.
You can approach the podium and start whenever you're ready.
I just want to make sure this is at a good level.
You can go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Valentina Defects from Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and I'm here on behalf of Planned Parenthood Marmonte and Dr. Doe. I am joined today at council table by Hannah Swanson and Bradley Schrager. For 40 years, doctors have provided abortions in this state without navigating SB 510's opaque requirements. That changed last summer when the statutes were allowed to take effect for the first time since their enactment in 1985. Under this scheme, doctors are required to notify a parent or ensure that an abortion is authorized through the judicial bypass process when providing an abortion to a patient under the age of 18, unless one of the rare exceptions applies. Yet SB 510 lacks guardrails, limiting how law enforcement will assess compliance with these requirements, and the provisions do not explain clearly how the judicial bypass process is intended to work throughout the state. The constitutional claims in this case are simple. SB 510 was unconstitutional in 1985. It was declared unconstitutional by courts in 91, and it remains null and void today under this court's void ab initio precedent. Independently, SB 510 is unconstitutionally vague, and it lacks the heightened protections that procedural due process demands. Because SB 510 is unconstitutional, we ask that this court reverse and remand with instructions to enjoin the statutes. I'd like to begin with standing and ripeness, the issues that are properly before this court. The doctors have brought a textbook pre-enforcement challenge to a statute that has minimal enforcement. They face prosecution if they provide an abortion without parental notice or a judicial bypass. Based on these facts, plaintiffs have standing to challenge the scheme in their entirety. This is consistent with Danforth, Wasden, and Miller, numerous other federal court decisions that have found that doctors have standing to challenge a judicial bypass scheme. As to ripeness, because SB 510 is in effect today, it is ripe for judicial review. Withholding review significantly harms doctors because their conduct is presently regulated and they face a threat of prosecution if they provide an abortion that is not authorized by the statute. Separately, the claims are suitable for review. This is a facial challenge where there is no need to develop additional facts. The text of the statute answers the question. SB 510 is unconstitutionally vague, and it lacks the protections that procedural due process requires. Separately, we ask that this court join numerous other courts throughout the country and formally recognize the existence of third-party standing and allow doctors to assert the rights of their patients. This is the natural extension of this court's precedent, where it has recently been willing to turn to federal precedent to determine whether a party has the ability to assert the rights of others, such as in the case of associational standing. It has also allowed third parties to assert the rights of another person in the case of Batson challenges in both criminal proceedings and civil proceedings.
Counsel, can I just ask quickly, what standard of review are we applying here? Are we in rational basis land? Are we in heightened scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny?
Given the claims before this court, none of those standards of review apply to plaintiff's challenge. However, for the vagueness challenge, the standard that applies to criminal statutes applies to considering whether SB 510 is unconstitutionally vague in its entirety. And that is because the statutes can be enforced against the providers, and they can be prosecuted if they provide an abortion that is not authorized pursuant to parental notification or judicial bypass.
And then more broadly, what relief are you seeking in terms of the injunctive relief?
We are asking that this court enter although this court has the authority to grant an injunction, we ask that this court remand to the district court with instructions to enjoin the statute in its entirety.
Enjoin the enforcement, or just in the whole statute, just enjoin it?
Because we're in the posture of a preliminary injunction, we ask that the court order the district court to preliminarily enjoin SB 510's enforcement. Okay. However, this court...
By the state, who's the other party to the case?
By the state or the attorney general. An injunction against either party is sufficient to grant the parties the relief that we seek, which would be preventing a prosecution. That is sufficient to establish redressability, and it is also sufficient to establish irreparable harm. And so, as I mentioned, we are asking this court to formally join the majority of courts throughout the country that have recognized third-party standing. Turning to SB 510's vagueness, SB 510 is unconstitutionally vague because its text lacks guardrails, limiting how law enforcement will assess whether a provider personally notified or whether they made a reasonable effort to notify before they then attempt to notify or provide notice via certified mail. In the abstract, it's easy to say that these terms are clear. SB 510 just requires a provider to provide notice to the parent personally or via certified mail. But when you ground this in the reality of the world in which doctors are required to practice in today, SB 510 doesn't include any guardrails and leaves doctors with the question of, did I do enough or should I have done more to provide notice? At the same time, the lack of limiting definitions that help narrow the type of conduct that may be prosecuted under this statute authorizes law enforcement to make ad hoc determinations of what a doctor could or should have done.
Doesn't the provision on the certified mailing provide some comfort in the sense that you do certified mailing? Is that not sufficient notice that would give them some level of comfort?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because providing notice via certified mail still doesn't explain what a provider is required to do. Does it mean that the provider has to ask for certified mail and the return receipt requested? Is it sufficient to print out the electronic notification from the post office? And I won't get into the intricacies of certified mail, but there's still no limit. And so this is similar to Flamingo Paradise, where this court held that when business owners did not have sufficient clarity to know if they did enough to stop someone from smoking indoors, the statute was unconstitutionally vague and it allowed for arbitrary enforcement. Here, the lack of guardrails into what it means to have notified via certified mail allows law enforcement across different jurisdictions to demand a different level of effort to provide notice via certified mail, as well as a different level of information that is required for a doctor to prove that they complied with that aspect of the statute. And that also doesn't take into
account... The state has taken the position, I believe, that actual notice is required, separate from the idea of certified mail in and of itself providing notice, that somehow the physician or their staff would need to find out whether there was actual notice received by a parent or legal guardian. Yes?
While the state has taken that position, that is not what the statute indicates. That is not the text of the statute. If the legislature had wanted, in 1985... to require that actual notice, there is proof that actual notice be received, they could have included that in the statute. Instead, they created a vague provision that says you have notified via certified mail. And I would like to flag one other thing about this clause that compounds the vagueness problem with it, which is that a doctor can only avail themselves to certified notice after they have made a reasonable effort to provide notice personally. But it is unclear whether what it means to make a reasonable effort. Does it mean that you ask the patient to bring their parent in? Or does it mean...
Counsel, isn't reasonableness a standard in a whole lot of cases that courts manage to grapple with, juries manage to grapple with? Why is that vague?
I think the issue with the use of the phrase a reasonable effort is that it is accompanied by an indeterminate term. And so it is still unclear what it means to personally notify, and it is unclear what a reasonable effort means. While you can say that there were reasonable efforts, a reasonable effort is a vague phrase in of itself. And so it allows for arbitrary enforcement and ad hoc determinations of what it means to attempt to personally notify before a doctor can avail themselves to certified mail, compounding the vagueness problem with the statute. Similarly, the inclusion of the term knowingly is not enough. As this court indicated in Childs, any discussion of intent is useless when there is a lack of definition that limits what conduct is prescribed. The use of the term knowingly here still sheds no light on what may be required to demonstrate that notice was provided personally, that there was a reasonable effort made, that the abortion was authorized through the bypass mechanism, or that notice was provided via certified mail. Separately, the statutes lack, or they violate patients' procedural due process rights because they lack the heightened protections that due process demands when there is a significant interest implicated. Here, as the state does not contest, there are two significant interests implicated in the statute. There is a significant property interest in having a bypass petition heard, and there is also a significant interest in the grant of a judicial bypass petition if a patient is able to demonstrate that they satisfy the statutory criteria. At the same time, though, the statutes exempt the process from the rules of civil procedure and from the rules of appellate procedure, leaving patients susceptible to a standardless system that fails to explain what a request is, when a bypass petition can be requested, how you go about filing a request, resulting in what can be a patchwork of systems throughout the state in which there is no clarity as to how the system is intended to be incorporated. And because it requires heightened protections, these protections and safeguards have to exist before the deprivation of procedural due process and before the deprivation of a protected property interest. Here, the bypass process does not include those protections. The district court erred in determining that in the context of a facial challenge, it was better for the parties to wait and see. But patients don't have the opportunity to wait and see. They're faced with navigating the scheme today, and providers face penalties if they provide an abortion to a patient that is not authorized to the judicial bypass process. Under Salerno, and a standard that applies to facial challenges, the text of the statute is enough to resolve whether the statute protects patients' procedural due process rights. SB 510 facially does not. At the same time,
can you explain why does it not? Like, if we need notice and an opportunity to be heard, of course, for procedural due process, why is this procedure set out in these statutes not enough on that?
Procedural due process demands more than just simply notice and opportunity to be heard. Notice and opportunity must be tailored for the circumstances. Since Goldberg and precedent interpreting Goldberg after the fact, courts have recognized that the type of notice and the opportunity to be heard must take into account who is subject to this process. Here, we're talking about young people that are pregnant that would be required to navigate a judicial system of which there is no clarity as to what it means for a request to be filed. So
there's a separate procedural due process standard applicable to pregnant minors?
No, Your Honor. Procedural due process is procedural due process as set forth in Matthews v. Eldridge, but the safeguards themselves have to be tailored to the person that is undergoing the process. So when you look at, for example, Goldberg, there in the context of, I believe it was a termination of public benefits, the court noted that you had to take into account that there were individuals that were considered indigent, that there was necessary safeguards that had to be suitable for the circumstances. That principle has been long affirmed by courts that due process and the Eldridge factors do take into account the context in which safeguards might arise. Now, we're not asking for perfection, and I do want to be clear because I've heard through the briefings this issue has come up a few times. What we're asking for is baseline safeguards to ensure that the procedural due process rights of patients are protected when they seek a judicial bypass. There has to be something that helps patients and any person that helps them navigate the bypass process that they can rely on and understand what this means.
Counsel, can you answer how a minor would avail themselves of the judicial system since they're not competent to file any kind of legal anything on their own?
Your Honor, you just identified the precise problem with both the argument that a young person can challenge the statute themselves, and this does go to the point that I was making earlier, that we asked this court to recognize the doctor's provider or the right to bring a claim on behalf of their patients. But separately, this is the problem with the bypass process. It remains unclear. First, I'd like to point out that you file a request for an interview, and that is before you actually get to the step in the process of having a hearing in district court. Now, the interview, while it is a judicial or process, it can also be a quasi-judicial process because it remains unclear, as Amici highlighted in their brief, whether in this process, an attorney that might be willing to help them might not be aware of, or it might be unclear, if they can actually help represent the patient in that interview. Are they able to speak on behalf of the patient? Are they required to sit next to them? Can they slip them a note? The statute does not answer any of these questions. At the same time, this process is the only mechanism that the legislature has provided separate from parental notification by which young people may access what is time-sensitive care.
And we don't provide them with an attorney until after a judge interviews them and declines a request for abortion care, and then we appoint them an attorney if they want to appeal that.
That is correct, Your Honor. And at the same time, the statute also doesn't indicate what is necessary to be submitted to request a bypass order. Are you required to bring in your medical records? Are you required to just simply call the court? Can you file a document? Now, the issue is there is nothing that indicates what is necessary, and there is nothing that prevents a separate type of system or separate requirements imposed. And these are the glaring baseline safeguards that are missing from this process. And so as we've identified in our briefing, there are a few other examples of statutes that include some safeguards. Now, I'm not indicating to this court today and asking that those are the exact safeguards that are needed to meet procedural due process, but what is clear is that SB 510 glaringly omits safeguards that are necessary, including safeguards, for example, that would require a patient to pay a filing fee, even if it's $5, but that could require a patient to pay a filing fee or submit, let's say, a cover page, a petition, a request to submit the petition for a hearing, and maybe extra documents. The statute contemplates this patchwork system, and this would be a system that a court could enact because it lacks baseline safeguards preventing these types of requirements and arbitrary haphazard systems that would impede the ability to have a bypass petition heard. Lastly, SB 510 is void ab initio because it was declared unconstitutional by a court in 1991. In the years since SB 510 was enacted, this court has at least three times affirmed the same two principles. First, when a statute is held unconstitutional, it is null and void. It is as if the statute never existed. Second, the only way to enact a statute that has been declared unconstitutional is through a full legislative reenactment. SB 510 is no different. SB 510 was declared unconstitutional by federal courts, both the Ninth Circuit and a federal district court in 1991 in Glick v. McKay. Based on this court's longstanding void ab initio precedent and these two principles that this court has long affirmed before SB 510 was passed, and in the years since then, it is void ab initio. It is null and void.
But, counsel, the federal court in that very case has since granted Rule 60B relief. So what do we do with that?
While the federal court granted Rule 60B relief on the basis of Dobbs and that it would be inequitable to enforce the statute in the future, void ab initio is a creature of state doctrine. It is a creature of state law. This court has reaffirmed these two principles, and under state law, this court has the ability to determine that SB 510 is null and void and cannot be revived, but rather must be fully reenacted within the confines of the authority that is granted to the legislature today under this state's constitution.
So the district courts ended up entering the judgment, the U.S. Yes. District Court,
yes,
back in the day, entered the judgment, permanently enjoining it, declaring it unconstitutional, right? And the parties decided not to appeal. But let's say it had gone up on appeal and ultimately got to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in an alternate universe, if the Supreme Court had issued what it said in Dobbs on this appeal in 1994 or something, reversing the enjoining of that act, it would then be effective, right? It wouldn't be forever void ab initio. right?
In that hypothetical, yes. I would admit that in that hypothetical, if in 91 it had continued the pursuit up to the Supreme Court. However, in this case, that is not what happened. In 91, the state and the defendants abandoned their quest to defend SB 510's unconstitutionality. They did not oppose the grant of summary judgment before the federal district court, and at that point in time, the declaration became final. This court has repeatedly stressed before the 1991 Glick decision and after that a declaration of unconstitutionality is deemed final. And this is grounded and it has its roots in the separation of power doctrine.
So we should deem it final even though the federal court that actually issued it doesn't and set it aside.
That is what we would ask this court in order to faithfully apply its longstanding void ab initio.
Let me ask you this. Why do we need to wrestle with the void ab initio doctrine in the context of this appeal from the order denying preliminary injunctive relief? What difference does it make?
We would ask, this is one of the grounds that this court can reverse the district court's decision and grant the...
But it's an alternate ground, essentially.
That is correct, Your Honor. This court, although SB 510, and we believe it is unconstitutional on various grounds, this is only one of the grounds that this court needs to agree with.
But it's not necessary to get into that whole doctrine and the questions that my colleague's posing on.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And so just lastly, as I was mentioning in terms of void ab initio, it's rooted in the doctrine of separation of powers, and that is intended to hold that the exercise of legislative power in excess of its constitutional authority is in perpetuity deemed unconstitutional, and it is of no effect. This court has reiterated that rule on multiple occasions, and there is no reason to depart from that rule for the purposes of evaluating whether a statute that was held unconstitutional in 1991 can be revived today by a federal district court absent the legislature's full reenactment, as this court has required in multiple
Have we ever weighed in, though, on this very unique circumstance where the predicate underlying bases for ruling it unconstitutional in the first place has now been overruled? Have we ever weighed in on that analysis?
No, Your Honor, not that I am aware of. Mm-hmm. But I would like to highlight that this court has previously declined to find that the amendment of a statute that was intended to address an issue that may have been deemed unconstitutional was sufficient to revive the statute. And in cases, and I apologize, I'm blanking on the case at this point in time, but in looking at the cases that are cited for the purpose of void ab initio, it's clear there has been examples cited where, for example, amending a statute that violated the single subject rule was not sufficient to remove the multiple subjects that would render it unconstitutional, was not sufficient to suddenly allow the revival of a statute. Mm-hmm. Rather, full legislative reenactment in those cases was required in order to revive such statutes. Here, it is no different. SB 510 was unconstitutional in 85. It was declared unconstitutional in 91. And it remains unconstitutional today. At the same time,
how should we, if at all, how should we view the existence of logic behind and use of triggering clauses? 13 states enacted abortion laws with triggering clauses that were unconstitutional when enacted pre-Dobbs, but which spring to life, assuming the U.S. Supreme Court did something, which they ultimately did. We don't have that here. So the fact that those exist, how does that impact the analysis of a void ab initio doctrine on a law that didn't have a triggering clause? I mean, why do we need triggering clauses if this law just lays dormant as opposed to being dead for all purposes?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, because I do want to make sure I understand it correctly, when you have a triggering clause, it means that the statute can only go into effect when it is constitutional. It is not an effort to defy the constitutional authority that has been delegated to a legislature. In those cases, void ab initio would not be a problem because the statute did not take effect at that time. Here, SB 510 was intended to take effect in 1985. The fact that it did not take effect for 40 years is because it was blocked by a federal district court through a temporary restraining order, a preliminary injunction, and then final judgment between 1985 and 2025. So if there was 40 years of invalidity and declarations that the statute was not allowed to take effect. And we ask for that reason that this court similarly determined that the statute cannot be in effect today absent full legislative reenactment. Because SB 510 is unconstitutional, that is also enough to establish that there is irreparable harm. Now, I do want to highlight that this case was filed in a pre-enforcement posture. The complaint was filed the day before SB 510 took effect, and the preliminary injunction was filed, I believe it was 2 days after the statute went into effect. Based on these facts, the record that is before this court right now is based on the need to prevent irreparable harm. While these facts are not before the court, there is ongoing irreparable harm, and that is evident from Amici's brief, as well as studies that have been cited and were cited before the district court. The existence of a bypass process delays and, in certain cases, denies access to health care and for young people, and it puts some of their physical and psychological well-being at risk. Now, these harms tend to fall disproportionately on youths from marginalized groups, such as those that are in custody of foster care, who may live in non-traditional families that have the inability to rely on a parent or legal guardian to help them throughout this process. The delays and the confusion caused by SB 510's enactment continue to harm both providers today who have had to change their practices out of fear of prosecution and deny care for reasons that are not associated in standards of care. Separately, though this court does not need to reach the issue of the public interest to grant appellants relief, as this court has consistently determined that this factor is not necessary for a party to establish that they are eligible to obtain a preliminary injunction, as the state does not contest the district court's public interest analysis, is in violation of the rule of party presentation. There was competent briefing below. The parties framed the issues. The district court admitted that it departed from what was raised in before it throughout its hearing and in briefing and introduced its own analysis into this. That is the quintessential violation of the party presentation doctrine that the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly held exceeds the authority of a district court of a court to decide issues based on the briefing before it. Separate from that, there are numerous other public interests that were implicated in that compelled the grant of preliminary relief, such as preserving the status quo, preserving access to health care when there were no questions or concerns associated with the standard of care. And, of course, there is no public interest in enforcing a law that is unconstitutional. If there are no further questions, I wish to reserve the remainder of my time.
I have one quick question.
Of course.
Similar to the question asked in Childs by the U.S. Supreme Court recently, to make sure that the state of proceedings as of today are the same as they were throughout the record.
I apologize. I could not hear that.
To your understanding, has the state continued to not disavow an intent to prosecute the statute if it remains viable?
We are not aware of any disavowal of enforcement from the state or the Attorney General's office.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think it's afternoon now, so good afternoon, Ms. Jones.
Okay, I was going to say good morning. Thank you for correcting me right off the bat. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Heidi Stern on behalf of the Nevada Attorney General and the Attorney General in his official capacity. Plaintiffs today have not established their entitlement to a preliminary injunction on the notice and pocket approval of provisions of NRS 442.255. They have no standing to seek such a preliminary injunction, let alone to maintain an action against those provisions. Preliminary injunctions are an extraordinary remedy. They require not only a concrete threat of injury, but an imminent threat of injury. Plaintiffs, while they have shown an intent to engage in the activity covered by the statute, they have not shown an intent to violate the statute. And they have not shown, more importantly, that their proclaimed injury is fairly traceable to the Attorney General or his office. There is currently no threat of prosecution from the Attorney General. While the AG has not disavowed the possibility that it might become necessary to prosecute under this statute, There's been no threat that that's happening. The Attorney General is perfectly willing to allow this process to play out, allow the courts to develop their systems to deal with this newly active statute. And finally, because of this, because there's no fair traceability, and any injunction in this case would not redress the injury that plaintiffs claim here. An injunction from the district court could enjoin only defendants in this case, which, as this court knows, are simply the Attorney General and his office. The concrete injury that plaintiffs have alleged is that there are district attorneys in the state who have threatened to enforce this provision. Nevertheless, plaintiffs, unlike in the federal district court action, have not named those district attorneys here, thereby taking them out of the possibility of being enjoined and actually solving the injury that they allege.
Ms. Stern, let me follow up.
I can't hear.
That's all right.
I apologize.
Seems to be a problem today.
Yeah.
I forgot my question. If they were, like, you say you're here as the AG's office, and clearly you are, but are you here as the state? Because even the DAs prosecute in the name of the state. So, like, if the state were to be enjoined from prosecuting, would that prevent, you know, just because it's a different law office, they still file criminal actions in the name of the state? Can you address
yes,
that?
Yes, I understand. The Attorney General cannot control the prosecutions of the district attorneys. There is no provision within NRS 228 that provides for that. In fact, if you look at NRS 228, I believe it's 130, it shows that the DAs have their own discretion to bring prosecutions, and the AG's role is quite limited. And this court's prior precedent upholds that. So any injunction against us as the state prosecutor would not enjoin the district attorneys, and we do not have the ability to stop them. Certainly, we could intervene.
As opposed to just the Attorney General?
It's the state at ex rel Attorney General. So yeah. It is the state, but even so, the counties are not involved. So I think Your Honor's question can be answered in two different ways. If it is the state as a whole, that doesn't include the district attorneys. And if it is just the Attorney General's office, of course, that limits it even further.
How would it not include the district attorneys who prosecute not on behalf of a county, and they work in a county, but they prosecute on behalf of the state? They don't go into court and say, I'm here, you know, on behalf of Clark County. I'm here for the state of Nevada.
I understand. It's really a question of what their discretion is. So they can say that they are here for the state, but their discretion is given to them by NRS 228. We don't have the ability to control that. If this court were to instruct the district court that it could issue an injunction against all state prosecutors, I suppose that would apply to district attorneys potentially, but that would be a legal fight. That's not at all clear from the statutes. In fact, I think the statutes show the opposite.
And we wouldn't really need to even get into that issue if we were to find that the statute was void ab initio, would we? Because then
that's not what this court is finding here today. So I think it's actually important to note, that's why I started the preliminary injunction issue, because what this court is doing is not finding whether the statute is void ab initio. This court is looking to the district court and deciding whether the district court abused its discretion in finding that the plaintiffs are unlikely to succeed on their constitutional claim that this is void ab initio.
Right.
And as Justice Pickering pointed out, that's only one prong of the likelihood of success.
Sure.
This court would only need to prove one of those. They allege vagueness as well as that. So,
no,
so.
Thanks for the clarification.
Sure.
But if they did succeed on their claim for saying it was void ab initio, then it wouldn't really matter if it was the Attorney General, the DAs, it would just be void for all purposes, wouldn't it?
I don't think, no, because any injunction can only be carried out against the defendants to the case.
But what did the district court say on the void ab initio?
I'm sorry, can I just answer her question a little more thoroughly? I'm so sorry. At the end of the case,
right,
there can be an injunction that enjoins the statute entirely. At the preliminary injunction stage, that is not available. hopefully that thoroughly. I'm sorry, Justice.
What did the district court say in regard to the void ab initio issue?
The district court found that it was a very unsettled area of law, which is correct. And mostly because of that, I think, decided that plaintiffs were unlikely to succeed.
So how would we, to the extent we were to reverse the district court on that finding, would we not necessarily kind of need to say something about the applicability of the void ab initio doctrine in Nevada?
You don't need to because of the abuse of discretion standard. You could.
If we were reversing her, we're saying, well, it's not really as unsettled as you made it sound.
I see what you're saying.
It's kind of settled and it favors yes. the plaintiffs.
Yes. So I would advise the court that you will not be able to do that. having looked extensively at this law, we could have a wonderful lunch where we discuss the intricacies of whether this statute is void and all of the new theories that have arisen, as Your Honor referenced the trigger laws and zombie laws and things like that. It is an incredibly unsettled area. The two main cases that I would say this court could look at for direction would be the Sister Song case out of Georgia and State v. Hodge in Ohio, which is actually a pre-Dobbs case, doesn't involve abortion, but provides some interesting discussion. Neither one of those cases is on all four with what happened here. There are no cases on all four with what happened here.
So let me go ahead and ask you the same question that I asked counsel about triggering laws. The
sure.
idea of a triggering law being necessary to have an unconstitutional law kick into gear when the U.S. Supreme Court changes its constitutional interpretation. Essentially, that's what the triggering laws did in the 13 states that enacted these unconstitutional laws pre-Dobbs. If the idea is that unconstitutional laws, no matter how old they are simply laying dormant until there's some future change by the U.S. Supreme Court, why would you need triggering laws? Conversely, absent a triggering law, wouldn't it be an indication that a unconstitutional law is dead and not subject to revival?
Okay. I'd like to try and give two answers to that. The first is that this is one of the rare occasions where plaintiffs and I agree that triggering laws are quite different because of their language and intent. So this is not that case. This was passed in a time when Roe was valid, 1985. It wasn't even declared unconstitutional by a court until 1991 because of the instability of the law. It's also not an abortion ban. So that's another difference between this law. And, you know, that would be part of our argument about why this wasn't void ab initio. It wasn't an abortion ban. Nobody knew what parental notification required at that time. And I may have lost sight of the end of your question, but but essentially my point is you can't take the trigger law and all of the discussion around that and apply it to this case and reach an outcome where you decide the district court was wrong, and that plaintiffs are likely to succeed.
I'm talking about a little bigger picture.
Okay.
Like the 30,000-foot view of triggering laws, triggering clauses in unconstitutional laws. What is the need for a triggering clause? What is the legal need and logic and existence and use of triggering laws if unconstitutional laws are simply laying dormant? There doesn't need to be a triggering law.
Oh, I think it adds to the clarity for the courts. Certainly, if you have a trigger law where that's the intent, it's blatantly unconstitutional, like you had that before Dobbs.
Right.
The cases that led to Dobbs were blatantly unconstitutional laws before they became constitutional.
This law was never unconstitutional?
Huh. It was unknown until 1991.
But in the decades leading up to the federal district court granting 60B relief, it was unconstitutional.
Until 1991, yes.
From the time it was ruled unconstitutional.
Yes. No, we're not contesting that.
Okay.
No. It was. Yes.
Okay.
I think that procedural posture matters here as well, though. So you're saying why have the triggering law? Well, to add clarity to the court, to show your intent. Legislative intent often, as you know, becomes relevant to courts looking at cases. But if you have a law like ours, which is to the periphery of the abortion discussion. It can become unconstitutional, but there is no conflict between this law, this court's definition of void and other courts' definition of what void means and considering this law dormant. There's no conflict there. This, you can consider from 1991 until 2025 that this law was not in effect. It was no law at all. It had no validity. That's true. But once it was determined again to be constitutional, it is now in effect. It doesn't, it's not a repeal, is what I'm, it's not a repeal.
Why wouldn't we, I mean, again, big picture, you have a law enacted by a legislative body in the past that's unconstitutional, it's found by courts to be unconstitutional. Wouldn't present day have the right to think that a present day iteration of the legislature would respond if some, if a present iteration of the Supreme Court decided to change constitutional interpretation, as opposed to being hindered with a law from 40 years ago in a different time that's supposedly just laying dormant?
I certainly think there's an argument to be made for that position. I don't think it's dispositive here.
Counsel, could you talk a little bit about the vagueness of the provision in and of itself as presented by opposing counsel?
Sure. And I'll start by saying that we do not believe that plaintiffs have standing to challenge the bypass provision. So I'd like to start with the vagueness alleged with regard to notice. And with regard to notice, there's two things that this court needs to pay attention to. Number one is it can assign regular everyday meanings to regular everyday words. And this notice provision uses regular everyday words. It uses words like reasonableness. It uses a phrase like personally notified. And it also, secondly, has something even more important based on this court's precedent, which is it has a scienter requirement. The doctor here must act knowingly. The doctor must know that he or she has performed an abortion without providing personal notice or certified mail to the parents of
the patient. Just quickly on that certified mail piece of it. When I was first reading it, I thought, oh, this is very clear, certified mail. But then I saw the state's position saying that not only do you have to send it by certified mail, but you have to actually show actual notice. I didn't read that into the plain language of the statute. And to me, by importing that additional step, it then makes it vague because I would not have thought that doing anything other than dropping it in the mail certified, I think that would have satisfied the statute. But your interpretation or the state's interpretation is that not only you have to do that, you have to make sure they got it.
I'd like to make a point of clarification with regard to that, because I think we may have more broadly stated what we meant. But I believe we meant to refer to the personally notified portion as an actual notice. The certified mail is an alternative to that if you cannot meet the personally notified requirement.
Okay, so you're not suggesting then that you have to take additional steps if you can't, you've done all of the reasonable things to try to contact them and personally notify them. You're not then suggesting that something beyond certified mailing needs to be done.
No, I don't. I think that would defeat the purpose of having an alternative to personal notification.
Okay, I agree.
and I will point out that there's a couple of things going on here with regard to looking at this statute that are important. And one is that plaintiffs raise a lot of good questions. They raise a lot of good questions. But the problem is none of those questions are actually what the statute requires. You're not allowed to read into the statute problems that don't exist in the language of the statute already.
Well, one of the problems that may exist is this pocket provision. So it's a default if the court doesn't get back to you within the statutorily prescribed time frame, which I think is like a day, and then it automatically defaults to being a grant. How is the doctor going to be able to prove or satisfy him or herself that this patient before him has been granted this default? Like, is there like a paper he can put? Is it there's record keeping requirements? So does he have to, like, what would he put in his file or she put in her file to show that she complied? So because there's a criminal element to this, I think it's important that we're very clear about compliance.
Okay. I think that you can use as an analogy the certified mail discussion that we just had. Because what the pocket approval is, it is the exception to the exception. It is the last ditch possibility. And so it requires nothing. And the record-keeping requirement reflects that. The record-keeping requirement does not require any record-keeping of that.
But how does the doctor know that it's more than 24 hours since the interview, and so they can assume it's an approval and proceed?
Basically, the doctor, if a certain amount of time passes under the statute, which is 3 judicial days, the doctor can go forward. That's how I read the statute.
Well,
if there's nothing from the court, 3 judicial days from the request.
Okay.
Yeah, so you have the request for an interview. The court has 2 days to act on that. The court, and then the court shall issue an order, and within 1 day, that order must be entered.
Within 1 day from the interview?
Yes, from the interview.
So how does the doctor know when the interview happened and when it's 24 hours after that without an order?
The doctor does not need to know, because the court must accomplish everything it must accomplish within the statute within 3 days. The it's not the doctor's responsibility.
How does the doctor know if it's been complied with?
The doctor
he's subject to misdemeanor criminal prosecution.
Only if he knowingly provides an abortion without notification or authorization or pocket approval is the third last-ditch effort.
Right.
So the doctor has to go check to see if an order was entered.
That's certainly something that would be reasonable to do, yes. Now, the statute does not say that the doctor has to do that, but I think the doctor, to satisfy his or her own scienter requirement, would do that. And if no order has been entered within that 3-day period, no order is going to be entered, because the court only has 3 days to do it. If it hasn't done it by that third day, the pocket approval provision kicks in.
Justice Bell asked your friends on the other side a question about the mechanics of this. How is this action commenced?
Yeah.
To initiate the interview, presumably if it's a minor, it's the records are sealed, so there's issues about checking the record and getting the copy of the order, the rest of it, the mechanics of it. And to what extent should we look at that as problematic in this appeal?
I think that the legislature, as the body who is in charge of policy, made this statute as flexible as possible, and it did that on purpose. It did that because it knew it would be dealing with minors, knew it would be dealing with pro se in a lot of situations, and it trusted the court system to be the ones who know how to make this happen. Now, it did put jurisdiction in the family court. I think that's very important. And in my earlier career, I did practice public interest legal aid law and handled a lot of domestic violence TROs. This reminds me of that. It's a situation where the person shows up in court. There's a self-help center, you know, in family court. They're used to dealing with pro se people. They're used to dealing with minors. And so the way that that request comes in is through that process that the court, the family courts, are very well equipped to handle. Now, Washoe County has already published a form online, very helpful. We certainly hope that Clark County will do something similar. But that is not a due process deprivation if this legislature doesn't lay out all of the requirements. As this court knows, sometimes procedures are helpful, sometimes they are a trap. And if this...
isn't it concerning that there's only one judicial district in the state that has published any information to pregnant minors who don't get attorneys until they're trying to appeal something, to give them any information about how they're supposed to go about this judicial bypass provision?
It's not a problem for this case, as far as finding of the statute. Whether this court thinks that is a problem, I do think it is something for the judiciary to resolve within itself. I don't think the legislature should have set forth procedures. That is not a problem.
If the court is supposed to have rules, I'm sorry, go ahead.
200 years of legal experience setting up here, and we're having discussions trying to figure out how much time is supposed to transpire and where the order is supposed to be on the doctor trying to figure out whether there was judicial bypass or the judge did what they were supposed to do or when's it supposed to get there. And we're expecting, and I think it's reasonable to assume, that many pregnant minors probably have other issues ongoing in their lives that have led to the situation that they're in. And somehow they're supposed to figure all this out.
I would direct your honor to Dr. Doe's declaration. I think it lays out, and to the actually the amicus submitted by the ACLU and Silver State Hope. Though Dr. Doe in particular says that the minors they come in contact with have a fair amount of understanding of what's going on. The Silver State Hope Fund and ACLU show that there are organizations out there that are ready to help these people. My own personal experience dealing with domestic abuse victims coming into court, my own personal feeling is, yes, there was notice and due process provided to those people, despite their being just coming in and telling the court their story. That was still due process. They had the ability to come in and take care of it. I would point out that these statutes, at the point at which the situation and the procedure becomes difficult, counsel may be appointed for them. They can request counsel. That would be the point at which they would come to this court, for example. But no, on a day-to-day basis, it's a difficult situation. There's no doubt about that. But I do believe that this statute and the Nevada courts are perfectly capable and are actually providing the services that are required by law.
Could you talk a little bit about us adopting potentially third-party standing? Maybe have things like associational standing, representational standing already in our jurisprudence. Council urges us to adopt the third-party standing that's present in federal court.
Yeah. I think this is a difficult case to adopt third-party standing in because the bypass procedures do not have any requirements placed on the doctors. The cases that are cited in plaintiff's brief where third-party standing was found fall into basically two categories. The first category is pre-Dobbs cases, where that third-party standing was based on the very strong constitutional right to an abortion. Now that that no longer exists, those cases are in flux. And in fact, as this court probably knows, in Dobbs, the Supreme Court identified third-party standing as one of the most problematic aspects of the law that stemmed from the privacy right to abortion. And so that law is, it's not a solid basis for this court to expand on. Okay, so then there's another category of cases, and that category of post-Dobbs, and that category of cases involves doctors who have some responsibility under the statutes, or they're claiming a First Amendment privilege. So, for example, one of the cases involves doctors needing admitting privileges to hospitals. Another one involves aiding and abetting a minor in obtaining an abortion, like out of state. Mm. And so those types of harms are maybe good places. If that was before this court, maybe that's a good place to expand third-party standing. Here, where all of the obligations of the bypass provision fall upon the court system, that is not a good place to, out of nowhere, expand this court's previous law prohibiting third-party standing, essentially.
To what extent has anyone argued that the absence of any voice for the parents with the Troxel-type rights that they have is problematic in this arena and in this procedural context?
I believe plaintiff's argument with regard to that was a party presentation argument. I think that's easily overcome by the facial language of the statute.
Okay.
You can't
okay.
ignore parental rights. That's what the statute is about.
Okay.
So I think we've talked about most of the things that I wanted to address today. Give me a moment, see if there's anything that I've missed.
If you could weigh in on the harm
yeah.
element of the preliminary injunction.
I do think that the irreparable harm claimed here is highly connected to the constitutional claims. I do think it probably rises and falls with the likelihood of success there. And maybe that'll lead me into sort of the last thing I wanted to say, which I've said, but I do think it's important that when this court looks at the preliminary injunction, it does two things. Number one, it needs to consider whether the preliminary injunction should be issued against provisions where there is no standing. We spent a lot of time talking about the bypass provision. there's no standing to challenge the bypass provision, either as a preliminary injunction or even in the case. Now, with regard to the notice and
Let me just push back on that, right? So the doctor is the one who's potentially subject to criminal prosecution and potentially loss of their profession being a doctor if they're so convicted of a misdemeanor, or I don't know, maybe even if they're prosecuted. I don't know in that regard. So, and they're obligated to make sure that this statute's been complied with before they perform the abortion. And so to say that, well, the bypass process doesn't involve them, maybe they're not the one going down to the court and meeting with the judge, but they need to know that it has been complied with in order to proceed with doing the abortion on penalty of criminal prosecution. So does it not affect them?
I think it's important for Your Honor to recognize that the state has conceded standing on behalf of the doctor with regard to pocket approval and notice. Those are the only parts of this statute where the doctor has obligations.
But how can you separate out the pocket approval from the bypass process? You wrote, like, it's all connected. You're not getting, as you've pointed out, we don't get to the pocket approval process unless they've done these other steps and had these other things happen.
That's not my position. Our position is a certain amount of time needs to pass before the pocket approval provision comes into play.
Amount of time after what?
After the judicial bypass provisions take place.
And how does the doctor know if that's happened?
No, I'm sorry. The 3-day, it's after the request. It basically all flows from the request, because there's a request for an interview. Once those 3 days are passed, the doctor is only responsible for the back end.
How does the doctor know if those 3 days have passed?
Because he or she knows which day the request was made by asking.
How?
Asking.
So
this statute allows you to ask.
If the pregnant minor tells them they've done it, that's enough.
That is enough. Under the plain language of the statute, that is enough.
What if a pregnant minor comes into the doctor's office and says, I told my mom this morning, therefore parental notification?
I believe it requires the actual physician. The physician has to personally notify. So that's just pursuant to the plain language. But yes, the doctor, pursuant to this statute, is allowed to believe what that minor tells him or her. Absent.
Where does it say that?
Oh, sorry.
it's just a knowing requirement. You have to, okay, so who is under the age of 18? There's no requirement included in there as to how you know whether the person is under 18. Doctors can believe when the patient comes in and says they're under 18. They can also verify. It's a flexible standard.
Doesn't that favor the vagueness challenge? Because this flexibility, like, it's making it sound like that's a good thing, but if you're acting at risk of criminal prosecution and your career and license as a doctor, I don't know that flexibility in complying with this is a good thing if we don't know, like, what has to happen.
Whether or not it's a good thing is a question for the legislature, but it does not affect what the plain language of the statute says. Maybe I would prefer that this said something different, but it doesn't. It says what it says, and this court is allowed to interpret it pursuant to the plain meaning of its words.
So the plain language indicates, in your view, that if the pregnant minor tells the doctor, I submitted my request on such and such day at 1 p.m., that's enough. And 3 days after that, if they don't know there's an order entered somehow, I don't know if with a confidential file, I don't know how they're going to know that that's happened and no order has been entered. But if that's happened, then they can proceed.
Well, one thing, just because something's confidential doesn't mean nothing appears on a court record. Certainly many things are.
We hope that's true.
Well, certainly many things in the family court our initials, things like that. So I would actually expect there to be a docket that the court could, that the physician could check. It doesn't say that things need to be sealed. It just says they have to be confidential.
But let me ask you, go back to your point about the pocket approval and the judicial bypass. Mm-hmm. The pocket approval can only be relied upon if judicial bypass hasn't occurred, right?
Hasn't occurred.
Meaning the judge has interviewed and the judge hasn't issued an order saying the
pocket approval occurs if the judge does not issue an order. That's correct.
Not act on the judicial bypass.
I guess that's one. That's another way of stating it. Yeah, I'm using the phrasing of the statute, but yes.
Kind of inextricably intertwined, right? When we say, well, you got standing to this, but not this, because this is different. I mean, they rely on each other chronologically and logically as to which part of it you have to abide by.
But the reliance is only on the end result. The reliance is not on everything that takes place within bypass. There's a lot of requirements within bypass that have no effect on the doctor.
Because it's flexible.
No, not in that case. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be flippant. But it's getting late in the day. But I do firmly read the statute as saying the doctor's not responsible for anything under bypass. He or she is only responsible at the end of that procedure if nothing happens on the court's end. The court is responsible.
But if there is
for
an
bypass.
Actual order, then the doctor is responsible for knowing if the order approved
yes.
or didn't approve.
Yes. And that would
so
be.
So that's part of the judicial bypass that's not a pocket approval.
But he's not responsible for. He's only responsible for knowing about the order. So none of the requirements within the bypass procedure are
he
something.
He doesn't have to be the one to go down and file for relief. He or she.
Correct. And I think it's important to note that if this court were to find that the doctor had some responsibility under bypass, that would be a very, very far from the precedent for third-party standing that other courts have found, where the doctor actually has a responsibility to do something like get admitting privileges in a hospital.
Oh, right.
This is far afield from that. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Hearn.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to try to keep it to 5 points, but I recognize that there might be a few questions. We're standing here today, months after the statute has been in effect, and we're having to use words like, I hope, I expect, I think, I believe. And we're asking how. And that tells you that this statute is vague and that it is constitutionally deficient because there are no baseline safeguards. We have now heard that there is one district court that has published forms. We don't know what's going on in other places. Those are the baseline safeguards that procedural due process demands. Now, a preliminary injunction is intended to preserve the status quo. The 40-year status quo in this case was disrupted last summer when SB 510 was allowed to take effect for the first time. At the same time, though, you know, we're talking about redressability, and I would like to point out that plaintiffs have established redressability. On this point, the district court was correct. However, I would like to indicate that there are two defendants in this case, as you have correctly noted. There's the state, and there's the attorney general. And under Rule 65D, an injunction can be served on the county attorneys, district attorneys, and local prosecutors who do act as agents of the state when they prosecute offenses. And so, while it is irrelevant whether injunctive relief prevents every form of harm, particularly when there's a pre-enforcement challenge, as the court, Ninth Circuit and Matsumoto, and federal courts have long held, what matters is that the relief that you are seeking can prevent the possibility of a prosecution. That is what our clients are asking for today. Now, the standard might be reasonable likelihood of success, but when the district court based its decision on legal errors, that is reviewed de novo. Here, the district court committed numerous legal errors throughout its decision. And while this, in the circumstances, I will admit, this is a little bit unusual and avoid ab initio. But what is not unusual is the fact that this court has repeatedly reaffirmed the same two principles. Once a statute is held to be unconstitutional, it is null and void. And it requires full legislative reenactment. Now, the right way to resolve this is for the legislature to craft a better and clear version of the statute that is within the confines of the authority that was granted to it. No party disputes that this statute was unconstitutional when it was first enacted. No party disputes, and it cannot be disputed, that it was held unconstitutional in 91. And under this court's void ab initio precedent, it remains unconstitutional today. Now, as to vagueness, as the justices have all highlighted, these are criminal statutes. We're talking about different ways that individuals may try to comply. Doctors are doing what they can, but the statute still says very little about what is required. And under Flamingo Paradise and this court's longstanding precedent governing criminal statutes, vagueness demands more than just simply, have you done the best that you can to take precautionary steps to avoid prosecution? It demands clarity. It demands guardrails to prevent ad hoc determinations of whether a doctor could or should have done more and whether they did enough. Unfortunately, knowingly is not enough to render the statute constitutional because it is still unclear what it means to have made a reasonable effort, what it means to have personally notified a parent or attempted to provide personal notice, what it means to have provided notice via certified mail. Lastly, the fact that we cannot say what a request is, that we cannot say how the system is supposed to operate, how you access the records for the pocket approval, indicates the precise procedural due process that exists today. There needs to be baseline standards. Due process may be considered flexible, but it does not change the fact that under Matthews v. Eldridge, a statute that implicates a significant property interest is entitled to heightened protections. SB 510 lacks such protections. Now, the reality is that doctors today are impacted by this. With every week that has passed since this statute has been in effect, doctors are doing the best that they can to provide health care that has been provided in the state for 40 years. Community groups have stepped in to assist doctors as well as patients in navigating this process. But due process requires that the government ensure that a statute is constitutional. It does not require and it does not allow for the government to rely on third parties to fill in the gaps that this statute includes. For this reason, we ask that this court either grant preliminary relief or, in the alternative, direct the district court to grant a preliminary injunction that would preserve the 40-year status quo.
Chief, could I ask just one quick question? Could you just address Ms. Stern's arguments about the third-party standing, the pre-Dobbs, post-Dobbs framework?
Yes, of course. Dobbs did not change Craig v. Boren and third-party standing. Third-party standing existed long before abortion cases, and it has continued to exist today in federal courts. Now, what I would like to highlight, though, is that third-party standing cases have not relied on whether there is a right to abortion. Craig v. Boren looked at whether there was equal protection. It is not rooted on whether you have the ability to assert a third party's right to abortion. It is rooted over whether a party is best situated to assert the rights of a third party. Here, the doctors have asserted that SB 510 violates their patients' procedural due process rights. And on those facts alone and those claims, the doctors have third party standing to assert the rights of their patients. And we ask that this court join the majority of courts throughout the country in recognizing their ability to do so.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The briefing was terrific. Oral arguments were wonderful today. I congratulate both sides on your presentations. The matter is going to stand submitted to the court, and the court will be in recess until the next call of court. Thank you.
All rise.